represented only itself. Hamas further asserted that Israel's use of such socially bankrupt and lawless gangs in Gaza reflects its utter helplessness. It stressed that Israel, which has failed to protect its own agents in Gaza, cannot protect any of its proxies. Hamas affirmed that unity of the Palestinian people will remain a bulwark against efforts made to undermine its internal fabric. Abu Shabab, who led an Israeli armed militia, was killed alongside his two deputies. His militia was accused of looting aid and attacking Palestinian civilians as well as Hamas fighters. His death has sparked street celebrations across Gaza. Hamas has also condemned the systematic execution of Palestinian abductees following Israel's confirmation that three civilians abducted from Gaza have died in its jails. Two of the abductees died respectively 2 months and just 1 day after being taken in by Israeli forces, while the third one died approximately 1 year after his abduction. Hamas called for immediate international intervention to force Israel to return the bodies of those who have died in its prison and hold perpetrators of such brutal crimes accountable. Hamas described Israeli prison conditions as barbaric, citing torture, deliberate medical neglect, starvation, and physical assaults. It called on the UN and other human rights organizations to open an international investigation into Israel's crimes against abductees. The movement also urged all possible pressure to be exerted on Israel to make it end its prison abuses, which blatantly violate the principles of international law. Over 100 Palestinian abductees have died in Israeli prison since October 2023, 50 of them from Gaza. Journalist and political commentator Eric Wahlberg joined us earlier to comment on the killing of three Palestinian abductees in Israeli jails. He believes the Israeli regime is intentionally killing Palestinian abductees.
Well, Israel wants us to see this. They're doing it openly. And if I were a Palestinian, I would be terrified. I would do everything to avoid being arrested and taken prisoner by the Israelis. So it really is an open declaration of that if we get you, we're going to torture you and probably kill you. And some of the tortures that I've heard of are unbelievable. I won't repeat them. They're just so horrifying. So it's intentional. Israel wants us to see how barbaric it is. It wants the Palestinians to be terrified and to leave. And this is all orchestrated. The U.S. is backing this as well. And Trump's so-called peace plan and the ceasefire, it's all a cover to allow an acceleration of arrests and destruction in West Bank. It's full-scale ethnic cleansing. We're watching it. It's not slow motion, it's in speeded up motion.
Among the ruins of Gaza's academic institutions, students have begun returning to what remains of their campuses, trying to challenge the Israeli systematic campaign to dismantle the territory's educational infrastructure. Our correspondent Gada Ibrahim has a report.
Students have begun returning to the shattered campuses of Gaza's universities, reopening notebooks among collapsed lecture halls in another act of defiance against the near-total collapse of the territory's higher education system.
The Islamic University is back to schooling today, sending a strong message of hope and determination. During the genocidal war, the Israeli army has deliberately destroyed most of the university's buildings and facilities. However, for us and for our people, education is a priority despite all the challenges. Now we've managed to reopen engineering, sciences, and nursing sections.
The devastation is perhaps most evident at the Islamic University of Gaza, once the largest academic institution in the territory, where buildings have been reduced to rubble, laboratories destroyed, and libraries set ablaze.
We are back to school again. Despite the challenges and the crises unfolding in every aspect of life, despite the transportation crisis and the lack of possibilities, we insist to continue learning. It is their target to decimate our education systems, but we are here to challenge them.
The students have returned. Despite the challenges of lacking learning materials, electricity, and coming on foot from distant areas.
Today marks our first day back after 2 years of genocide. The university lies in ruins, yet we are eager to return and continue the educational journey we began. The challenges are immense, both for the institution and for us as students. We navigate destroyed roads with great difficulty from our displacement areas, but there is a sense of relief in finally reclaiming a normal life.
In the ruins of Gaza's shattered campuses, the act of learning has become an assertion of existence, an insistence that even amid wreckage, an educated future is still worth striving for. Adam Rahim, Gaza City, Palestine.
To Europe now, where the national broadcasters of Ireland, Spain, and the Netherlands have announced that they will boycott the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest. The announcement came after the European Broadcasting Union decided to allow Israel to participate in the upcoming competition. The three countries were among several parties that have called for Israel's exclusion, citing the heavy human toll in Gaza and the accusation of unfair voting practices. Earlier, Eurovision said it will not hold a vote on Israel's participation in the musical contest, dodging calls for the regime's ban over its ongoing crimes in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. The decision prompted the three broadcasters to confirm their withdrawal, citing that it does not reflect the ethical values of the contest, should uphold. Other international bodies such as the International Federation of Association Football, FIFA, have also sidestepped calls to bar Israel from participation in competition over its genocide in Gaza. Critics say these refusals point to double standards that have shielded Israel from accountability. They cited past actions against countries such as Russia, which was swiftly banned by FIFA and UEFA within days of Russia's attacks in Ukraine in 2022. An investigative journalist, Tony Gosling, says the Eurovision controversy over Israel's participation exposes deeper problems in the global music industry. Let's take a listen.
The music industry has been infested by money and people trying to make money from it and people using it for propaganda, like the Israelis. So it's really good to see the Dutch, the Spanish and the Irish and the Slovenians all saying, we're having nothing to do with this anymore. So for two reasons, really. One is it's run its course. There are better songwriters and singers on the streets of Bristol busking for a few pennies from passers-by than you'll find in this Eurovision Song Contest nowadays. If you go back over the last even 30 years, back to apartheid South Africa, you'll see that many musicians who are actually good at what they do, I'm talking here about people like Eric Clapton, etc., Van Morrison, people who've got a little bit of integrity as a musician, and they're not just looking for the money from the music industry, they have boycotted many, many events. For example, Israeli events, Israeli-sponsored events. Back in the 1980s and early 90s, it was South African events. And so you can see that the pressure, political pressure, that musicians can put on, they're very much aware of that. And so this is really echoing the very best, but this boycott, of the British musicians, the British music industry that we've seen over the years, boycotting racism.
And to Iraq, where the country has launched an urgent investigation after Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah resistance groups mistakenly appeared on its funds freeze list for terrorism. A publication, the Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani says, contains inaccurate language and does not reflect state policy.
In a shocking development, Iraq's official newspaper published a set of government decisions, the most notable of which was the freezing of assets belonging to Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemeni's Ansarullah resistance groups, and listing them as a terrorist organization. The Iraqi government quickly issued a statement through the Prime Minister Mohamed Shiaz Sudani denying the decision while directing an urgent investigation to identify those who were responsible for the mistake.
I believe what happened is a mistake that affects the dignity, will, and conscience of Iraq and Iraqis. Acknowledging the mistake is good, but addressing those responsible, punishing them, and investigating those behind them is necessary. At the same time, there should be vigilance because in the future, there might be greater embarrassment for the government and state, which could harm the reputation of the Iraqi people.
As Sudani affirmed that the Iraqi government is dealing with this error with a full seriousness, stressing that it does not reflect Iraq's real position and that the corrective measures must be taken to fix the course and prevent such mistakes from reappearing in official decisions in the future. Meanwhile, observers believe that this list may have been an attempt to court the United States.
We were taken by surprise in media and political circles when a decision emerged from the Anti-Money Laundering Committee, formed by the General Secretariat of the Council of Ministers, whose outcomes were published in the official newspaper. Upon verification, it became clear that the decision included placing Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarallah on the terrorism list and freezing their assets. Such a classification contradicts the policy of the Iraqi government, goes against the sentiments and fundamental principles of the Iraqi people, and is inconsistent with the guidance of the religious authorities, which have repeatedly stressed the importance of supporting the Palestinian cause.
The Iraqi Central Bank issued a statement removing Hezbollah and Ansarullah from the list, but a wave of questions has emerged in Iraq about how such incorrect wording made its way into an official document, and as attention turns to the result of the investigation ordered by the Prime Minister, the major question remains, how did these errors reach the official gazette, and what are the potential political implications? Between denials and political reaction, the most important question remains, was the list issued by the Iraqi government under American pressure following the recent official visit of the U.S. State Department, or was it a mistake as described in the Prime Minister Mohammed Shah Sudani's statement? Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
And to Iran now, where the country has marked the International Day Against Unilateral Coercive Measures by condemning unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. as illegal and inhumane. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei argued that unilateral coercive measures violate fundamental principles of human rights, such as the rights to life, health, education, and development. He added that by targeting the lives and health of entire population, unilateral bans amount to crimes against humanity. Baghaei stressed that the U.S. must be held accountable for committing crimes against humanity through application of illegal and inhumane sanctions against the peoples of developing countries, including Iran. Washington has imposed hundreds of sanctions on Iran under various pretexts, ranging from human rights to the country's peaceful nuclear program. The International Day Against Unilateral Coercive Measures was designated by the UN General Assembly through the adoption of a resolution in June 2025. Robert Englash says unilateral U.S. sanctions are designated and designed to pressure other states into submission. Let's take a listen.
They essentially use the sanctions to bully countries into being their slaves. There's no other better way to put it, to be honest. That has to be put bluntly like that. If you are not the slaves of the United States, if you don't implement certain social programs that you want to, if you don't change your culture to in the way that the United States seeks for you to do so at a certain given moment in time, and if you do not adhere to constraints and to the demands of its foreign policy, then you will be torn apart. And if you have resources and the United States wants those resources or wants certain deals, it is like a gangster. It holds a gun against your head. The sanctions are there, and then you know that right around the corner is its military, which is, of course, one of the most powerful on the planet. There is no way to prevent this. It is a matter of nations which are, like you said, in this emerging multipolar world on the opposite side of the political divide to come together and work with each other independent of the United States.
And that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. As always, more is on our website to keep you updated. Thank you so much for joining us. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kaveh Tahweh. Today's featured guest is Matthew Kennard. Now, Matthew Kennard is an author and independent investigative journalist. He was also the former head of investigations at Declassified UK. He was a fellow and then director at the Center for Investigative Journalism in London. Now, he's also author. Some of the books that he's written, we can mention Irregular Army, Silent Coup, and The Racket. And The Irregular Army goes on with the title How the U.S. Military Recruited Neo-Nazis, Gang Members, and Criminals to Fight the War on Terror. Matthew Kennard, welcome to Unscripted.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I'm going to zoom in and focus more on how you have uncovered some great topics to your independent investigative journalism that you, I think, is what you'd like to obviously pride yourself in. And I'm going to start out with the Israeli lobby, and in particular how that works and operates in the UK. You've paid much attention to Keir Starmer. You have also, in your investigation, talked about how some 180 of Britain's 650 MPs in the last parliament accepted funding from pro-Israeli lobby groups. You gave a breakdown of which the total value is about £1 million. That's a hefty sum. Tell us more about this, if you can.
Yeah, so the Israel lobby is extremely powerful in the UK. And up until really the last couple of years, it's got away with cultivating and co-opting our political class without much coverage or pushback. And there's still not much coverage in the mainstream media, but alternative media has picked up on this story in the last 2 years, because I think people have been asking themselves why, when you are seeing the horrendous crimes of Israel and Gaza, genocide, the mass murder of children, the destruction of a whole culture and people, why is our government supporting it? And not only just supporting it diplomatically, but supporting it militarily and in an intelligence capacity as well. And I think people have been wondering that and are now starting to see, well, actually, a major reason is because the Israel lobby works on politicians tirelessly from when they enter politics, and maybe even before as well. Now, there's various different mechanisms through which they exert control. The most obvious ones are lobby groups embedded in the main political parties. So we have something called Conservative Friends of Israel and Labour Friends of Israel. Both those organisations are hugely powerful and have huge numbers of MPs and Lords as members, but they don't disclose their funders. But what they do is they get politicians early in their careers and take them on all expenses paid propaganda tours of Israel and also the West Bank, basically to get them on side and make sure that further down the line, if they become ministers or they're sitting in parliament, they basically do the bidding of Israel. There's also, of course, a whole ecosystem of Israel lobby groups that don't call themselves Israel lobby groups. Unfortunately, many Jewish communal groups or that claim to represent the Jewish community have been co-opted by the Israeli state and used their platform and used their organizations to smear and destroy any critics of Israel. And we saw this in a very real way during the leadership of the Labour Party by Jeremy Corbyn. He was vociferously attacked by organizations like the Board of British Deputies, by Jewish Labour Movement within the Labour Party. And many people don't want to talk about it because they don't present themselves as Israel lobby groups. They represent themselves as organizations representing the Jewish community. And I wish they did represent the Jewish community, but they don't. They represent the Israeli state. So there's two ways to do it. There's one is just a cultivation, funding MPs, embedding organizations within the main governing parties. And there's also smearing and destroying critics of Israel through accusations of anti-Semitism and racism, effectively, okay, against Jewish people. And it's very powerful and does work.
Well, from what I'm gathering here, it's somewhat parallels and is very similar to how AIPAC operates in the U.S., from what I understand, especially the part that you say that they actually groom some of these politicians. And from what I gather from you, Friends of Israel is one of the most significant funders of conservative Friends of Israel, from what I understand, CFI, this group. Tell us, if you can, you know, there's always this question as to, okay, so there's money that in the form of donation that's given to them. So that obligates them to act and be the voice in decision-making, and obviously not to have any rules or laws or even a stance that's anti-Israel. But is there more to the story in terms of how it is, how it holds a grip on the MPs? That's the part that I'm most curious about, because we see them go all out. Of course, that's waned down, but we see them MPs go all out for Israel in a variety of cases.
Yeah, so it's the funding, like you say, like AIPAC in the United States, which funds political campaigns. We have that here as well with individuals often that don't present themselves as representing Israel, but effectively do represent Israel. And they fund politicians, they fund their offices to huge amounts of money, and a majority of MPs get funding like that. And then there's also, but Labour Friends of Israel as well, and Conservative Friends of Israel, are embedded within the parties. So they have these people going to their events, going on their trips, and obviously it's their fronts for the Israeli embassy in London, and that's a big claim, and I can back it up. So for example, Al Jazeera did a very important investigation during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of Labour called The Lobby, which went undercover within the Israel lobby, and particularly Labour Friends of Israel. And they recorded a official within Labour Friends of Israel saying, "We work very closely with the Israeli embassy in London. When bad things happen and Israel's getting attacked in the media, they send us things to say in the media." So it's a front group. They also recorded an official from the Israel lobby, from Labour Friends of Israel, offering or promising £1 million to the chair of Labour Friends of Israel. All of this stuff, barely any of it got covered in the mainstream media, but that kind of control is very, very real, and is, I think it's an outrage. You know, I want I don't want any lobby groups in the UK to be controlling our policy and our foreign policy, whether it's Israel, whether it's Saudi Arabia, whether it's Bahrain. Every country has a lobby, but the Israel one is particularly powerful. And in fact, there was a very good memoir written by a foreign minister called Alan Duncan, who was foreign minister from 2016 to 2019. And I think that's the best window into how the Israel lobby works in the UK. And he said when he was going to be appointed Middle East minister by Boris Johnson and Theresa May — Boris Johnson was then foreign secretary and Theresa May was prime minister — there was a call made to Theresa May's office, the Prime Minister's office, from Conservative Friends of Israel, who said, "You cannot appoint Alan Duncan Middle East Minister because he has a moderate view of the Israel-Palestine conflict. He supports a two-state solution." That was too much for them. Mm-hmm. And what happened? Theresa May, the Prime Minister, the democratically elected Prime Minister, the person we're told is the most powerful person in the UK, listened to Conservative Friends of Israel and refused to appoint him Middle East Minister. And that was only because this lobby group. So that's a taste of how much power they have. And then, of course, in those memoirs, Alan Duncan, who's a conservative — he's not someone I agree with politically — but he said he was talking to the permanent undersecretary of the UK Foreign Office, and he said to him, "The Israelis think they control the Foreign Office, and they do. That's a line. Again, that line wasn't covered in the mainstream media, but that kind of control of our foreign policy is wrong and immoral, and it has been for a long time, but it's particularly wrong and immoral when you're talking about that foreign country that is having, that has that much power over our political system, committing a genocide, and that's been found by the UN just this week. So I hope that when light is shone on it and people hear about it, there's enough outrage that we can shut it down, because it's an embarrassment.
Well, indeed, there's so many cases that we can mention. One of them that stands out right now, which is pretty recent, and I'm sure you've talked about this, but I'd like to hear from you in this program, and that is the case that involves Palestine Action that was branded as a terrorist group. Now, what's interesting here, unfortunately, is the fact that when we talk about the Israeli lobby, my question to you is how and if it's the case where the influence of the Israeli lobby is so wide that it actually can affect laws, because we know that this has led to things like state persecution of journalists, for example, if I'm correct to say that. I mean, you have parts of Starmer's regime that is using anti-terror laws, misusing them, I should say, if you agree with that, in order to basically to shut down journalists. And that's happened in some cases that you have even mentioned yourself, like Aswan Stanley, who works for Electronic Intifada, coming into his home, raiding it, and they took all his computers, etc. So is the Israeli lobby in one form or another somewhat directing this for the Starmer government to act in such a way to misuse the law?
Well, I think that since the Labour government have come in, particularly in July 2024, we've seen unprecedented attacks on our civil rights and rights as journalists. One case which you mentioned is Asa Winstanley, who's covered the Israel lobby in this country more than any other journalist. And he had his house raided by police, his electronic devices taken. That was actually found to be unlawful by another court eventually, and he got those devices back. But he wasn't even charged with anything. And we don't know, because we don't know what conversations are happening within the corridors of power, but whether that was directed by Israel. But it's highly likely that they were involved, because he's a thorn in their side. And why would they take such extreme measures against the journalist that it had never happened before, who was covering the genocide? I don't think that it's preposterous or a conspiracy theory to say that they would be involved. It also happened to Richard Medhurst, another independent journalist. He was arrested at Heathrow and kept in solitary confinement for nearly 24 hours. Sarah Wilkinson, another journalist. All stuff that has not happened before. And this is misuse of terror laws. And that brings us up to Palestine Action, which is, again, unprecedented, because these are activists who are trying to stop the genocide, non-violent activists. They only destroy the machinery of genocide and weapons. And they were proscribed under the Terrorism Act of 2000. That had never happened before with the Direct Action Group. And that, more clearly, you can link to the Israel lobby, because people like Lord Woolney, who's John Woodcock, has been pushing for that for years, and he's associated with the Israeli lobby. He's also associated with the Saudi regime as well, and arms companies. And they were pushing that hard. And it's not a surprise. If you're an Israel lobbyist in this country, in the UK, you want the government to take out people who are raising the alarm, either through journalism or throwing their bodies on the gears of the genocidal machine if they're activists. And they've successfully done it. They've done it to the point that it's become an embarrassment. You know, the proscription of Palestine Action has been challenged hugely by popular movements. And 1,000 people nearly the other day were arrested under terrorism laws. A lot of them grannies and grandpas and vicars and disabled people, just normal people who are getting charged under terrorism laws for supporting a group which is trying to stop the genocide. And I would say, yes, it's very, very clear that the Israel lobby plays a role in that. Also, the arms industry as well, because although Palestine Action have just mainly targeted Elbit, which is Israel's largest weapons company, obviously, if you have activists trespassing and destroying weaponry on those sites, it's not good for the whole arms industry, which is why I think what they have done is it has civilized British society, because it's made it harder for these weapons companies to base themselves here. But yeah, it's clear that the Israel lobby plays a role. I have to say as well that the Israel lobby and Israel itself see what's happened in Britain particularly as a defeat over the last 2 years, because you've had often the biggest demonstrations in the world on the streets of London, you've had Palestine Action, you've had all these different groups really changing the opinion of the population at large on Israel. That it's at its lowest point that it's ever been, Israel, in terms of its favorability ratings. So in a situation where you have the state and its media pumping out the propaganda, pumping out the genocide propaganda, and no one, the population at large, not buying it anymore, the only thing you can do is then revert to the law. And this goes back as well. It's not just Palestine Action. You know, the proscription of Hezbollah in 2019, that was explicitly at the behest of the Israel lobby. Lord Polak, who is maybe the main Israel lobbyist in the UK, he did an interview where he said they were talking about trying to prescribe. The Israel lobby's next goal, or has been for a while, is to prescribe the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And he was asked about this. He said, what we need to do is pure lobbying. It took us a while with Hezbollah, but it eventually worked. So that he was admitting that they lobbied hard to get Hezbollah prescribed, because it's not in Britain's interest in terms of, because prescription basically means you can't negotiate, you can't talk to, you lock off a channel of communication. And as a country that has a foreign policy and wants to keep its channels open, you don't want to prescribe all these different groups that have power. Like Hezbollah has ministers in the Lebanese government. And in 2019, they prescribed the political wing of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. So it completely locks that channel off. So I think that decisions are being made in the UK Foreign Office, within the UK state, at the behest of the Israel lobby, that are to the detriment of British national interests.
Right.
And that's because the level of power is so high.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Hezbollah, because Theresa May's government took that decision, as you said, to prescribe it as a terrorist group. And the reason that it gave, and quote, it's because they no longer saw it tenable to distinguish between the military and the political wings of Hezbollah. This is basically the narrative that the Israeli regime wants out there in order to make sure that the whole definition of resistance is not something that the general public can understand. And they try very hard, I think, if I'm correct to look at it that way, to push that aside and to form what they want to be out there, which is, again, no longer tenable to distinguish between military and political wings of Hezbollah. Is that a correct way of looking at it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that what's not commonly understood is that I think the main reason for the prescriptions of Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestine Action, all these groups, because Hamas and Hezbollah have never targeted the UK, it's the primary goal is not to criminalize membership, which is one part of that act. I think the primary goal is to stop people being able to speak openly about these groups who are resisting Israeli colonialism and Israeli genocide, because there's two parts to that, the Terrorism Act. If you prescribe an organization, yes, it's illegal to be a member, but it's also illegal to voice support. So, and that's why I think they do it. They want to clamp down on the ability on free speech, on the ability of people to speak openly about the conflict. I'm not saying you have to support these groups or everyone supports these groups, but the ability to have an open conversation about the rights and wrongs of resistance, about the situation within Lebanon, within Gaza, within Israel. You can't have it in the UK now. People are being arrested all the time for just speaking and having political conversations. I mean, an example I use sometimes is during the Vietnam War in the 60s and 70s in the United States, the Viet Cong, many, many people supported the Viet Cong who were resisting the American invasion. That was in America. The idea that it would become illegal to support the Viet Cong is unthinkable, or would have been unthinkable there. But here, you cannot talk openly at all about this stuff. And I think that's the purpose of it. That's the purpose of it, because they know they're losing control of the narrative. They're losing control of the population, and they don't want people to be able to speak openly about it, because once you clear away all the Israeli propaganda, the situation looks very, very different to how it's presented in the media. I mean, everyone knows that the way that Israel have got their genocide done, and often all the other crimes that they do, is they just say Hamas, 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 Hamas. Like, there's no other argument. So if people don't feel like they can push back against that argument in an open way, then it gives it scores them a victory. And that's the situation we have in the UK here.
Well, when this September 16th Independent International Commission of Inquiry published its report on the OPT, where it said for the first time that Israel has committed genocide, it seems like that has struck a chord, although I find it to be somewhat, I'm not too sure what word to use, that we're still talking about whether this is a genocide or not, but it's better late than never, in a sense. But after 2 years for this report to come out, I think that is part of the problem, whether this conversation is still looking at whether this is a genocide or not. Maybe you can comment on that, but what I find interesting is one of your posts that said even the BBC has a new UN report as its main story, and this is the part that I found interesting, that you said the walls are closing in, every genocider and every accomplice will be held to account. We have 2 years' worth of receipts.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that it's, well, I think you said you couldn't think of the word, but I find it disgusting that it's taken 2 years for the UN to find this, and for certain politicians to finally come out and say it now, because it was clear within a week that it was genocide, because they were not targeting military facilities, they weren't targeting Hamas, they were targeting the civilian population from the beginning. And it was so obvious, you know, by December 2023, so 2 months in, 10,000 kids were killed. That wasn't a mistake. They were targeting civilian infrastructure, and you see, and now it's even more obvious with the complete destruction of Gaza, the toppling of all the towers in Gaza City, which has been happening recently. They're erasing the whole of Gaza, but the program has never changed. They decided after October 7th that Gaza was finished. They were going to enact their final solution. So it's if the media had covered it how they should have, if the institutions which were told oversee international law and the international system had used the evidence and viewed the evidence dispassionately early on, then we might not be here. Because 2 years later, yes, it's good that the UN's finally found it. It's good that politicians like Bernie Sanders has finally said it's a genocide. It's good that the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has said it's a genocide. But where have they been for the past 2 years? And if this pressure had been born earlier, we might not be where we are. It might be that Israel would have had to stop earlier, because the other thing is, Israel's a small country with a small population, a relatively small GDP, and it couldn't survive without the support of the Western nations, particularly the United States, but also Britain and Iran. Britain and Germany. So if the political climate and the pressure had been borne on our political classes to stop support, which has been intensive and direct, then Israel might have had to stop. Now they're talking about sanctions, but why weren't they sanctioning straight away? Why weren't they sanctioning when thousands of kids have been killed and targeted? So I find it pretty disgusting. The other point of it also is people are trying to now save face, because it's so obvious what's going on that they know that how history will view this now, and they know how history will view their silence for 2 years. So now they're trying to say, well, it's a genocide and this is awful, but we know what has happened for the past 2 years. We know all the people that sure. were either giving support or being silent, and we will not go away. We will remind them of that till their dying day, because this is one of the worst crimes in history, and the people that supported it and the people that stayed silent allowed it to happen. Indeed. So, Yeah.
When you say they're trying to save face, you know, it sounds like this genocide is winding down in a sense, but which I hope to God it is. You know, many people obviously around the world are just sick and tired of seeing these, and they're really shocked and keep getting more shocked. But we may be looking at a point in time in history where not only has this genocide not subsided yet. We're looking at many other genocides, and I would hate to see that happening, but we're seeing the sparks of it happening already in this region, initiated by Israel. Look at what happened in Lebanon. Thousands killed there. The Islamic Republic of Iran. We had over 1,000 people who died, many of them, a large majority, women, children, the same scenario, of which this falls under that umbrella that Israel must expand itself. So something needs to be done now. You have the fact that there's an obligation where every country that's put on notice by the ICJ was a plausible risk of genocide in Gaza. Every country is obligated under international law, not to just speak words, to take action. That means the Genocide Convention says that other countries have to therefore step in. So other countries need to step in. Do you think that we've reached that point now that we're seeing this genocide to have happened in Gaza?
Yeah, I do. And I think that we need military intervention, if possible, organized by the UN. Because as you say, the conventions that were signed after the Second World War and after the Holocaust stipulate that nations should take action when a genocide is underway. And ironically, of course, it's not the Western nations obviously should intervene to stop it. But as a first step, what they should do is stop supporting it and stop directly supporting it through military and intelligence help. You know, the US is providing huge amounts of arms. In fact, nearly all the arms, and the Germans as well. That should stop. The British are providing huge amounts of intelligence for them to get their operation done. That should stop. So that should be the first port of call. But yeah, eventually it should. Because as you say, we're in a new world now. Everything has been exposed. The mask is off. Israeli power, but particularly Western power as well. Because as I said, Israel is effectively a colony of the West in the Middle East. And I don't think there's any way back. There's no way back. There's a new world. Either we create a new system which actually works and actually does what it says, or we're in the law of the jungle. Because Israel, it has no red lines, has no obstacles to any action they want to do. It's not just the attack on Lebanon, which was horrific, as you said, Iran as well. They bombed Qatar the other day. And that's a country that is effectively an outpost of the U.S. empire in the Middle East. They got the biggest U.S. base in the Middle East at Al Udeid. Over 10,000 American troops are there. And they just bombed it openly and apparently with the knowledge of Trump. So I think that more red lines will be crossed. They don't care. In fact, I actually think they flaunt it because they want people to be scared. Yeah, I said it's a gangster mentality where the Israelis want to project the image that they are completely all-powerful and no one can raise a finger of dissent or resistance against them. Otherwise, they'll be wiped out, and not just them wiped out, but everyone they know wiped out, their families, their friends. It's very similar, and I don't just say this for rhetorical purposes, but it does remind me very, very explicitly of the Nazis. The Nazis had the same mentality. They used to, if there was any resistance to the Nazi army, they would destroy whole towns and whole villages. It was a maximalist ideology, much like Zionism. So, and Netanyahu and his administration, they see October 7th as the event that they can use to justify any action. And that they think we're never going to get this chance again. So we want the final solution to the Palestinian problem, but also the Middle East problem, which is that there is resistance to this settler colony. So they are going all out. The level of depravity and terrorism is unprecedented as well. If you look at another country which we haven't even mentioned, which they've been mercilessly bombing, is Yemen. Last week they bombed a Yemeni media facility, and they killed 31 journalists in one go, which might be the biggest single massacre of journalists in history. I don't know. I haven't looked into it, but that barely even made the papers in the UK. So this is
you talk about how they killed almost the entire government setup and personnel.
Exactly.
You know, yes, I mean, these are targeted assassinations, you know, and when you talk about the level that the Zionist entity or Israeli regime can go and execute some of its plans in order to make sure that people are intimidated and scared of it. Today is the one-year anniversary of those pagers that went off in Lebanon. I mean, look at what they did there. That included cell phones as well. I mean, that's the extent that they go to. We can talk about that, but given the time restraint that we have, you mentioned about how we should, we've reached that point in history, we're in agreement there, and something needs to be done, and you talked about the UK, for example, providing intelligence. I found that this banner on your account to be very interesting, where on September 28th, I guess, there's going to be a protest, and the part that was interesting was the header, where you said spy planes from Nevada, paid for by British dollars, launched from RAF, Akrotiri in Cyprus, which provides intel for Israel to bomb Gaza. Which again, the question is, aiding an entity committing a genocide, doesn't that make that person guilty of genocide as well? But my question is, tell us more about that involvement of the UK when it comes to intel, and when it comes to even having boots on the ground, perhaps, in the Gaza Strip, which there were some stories on that.
Yeah. So on the intel side, Britain has been a major player on providing intelligence from Gaza to the Israelis. Now, this was a story I've been covering for nearly 2 years now. But to summarize, basically in December 2023, the UK government announced it was going to put spy planes over the sky in Gaza in support of Israel. They didn't say where they were going from or how long they were in the air or what plane it was going to be, but I tracked it down to RAF Akrotiri and saw that they were going nearly daily, and still do, by the way. And they were in the sky for 5 hours. You could see the takeoffs and landings on flight tracking websites, but they turned their transponder off over the sea, so you could never see what they were doing over Gaza. But on July 28th, the pilot forgot to turn off his transponder for the first time, and we saw that it was circling Khan Yunis for nearly 2 hours. Now, the UK government had always said this is to do with hostage rescue, nothing else, nothing to do with the military campaign. But that we understood when we saw that footage or that video of the spy plane over Khan Yunis, why they turned their transponder off. Because all the fighting was happening in Khan Yunis. The Israeli government itself doesn't even think the hostages are in Khan Yunis. They think they're in either in the center or the north of Gaza. So why were we over Khan Yunis, where all the main fighting was happening? And the mainstream media had never covered this story beforehand, but subsequent to us finding that video and publishing a story about it, they got interested. And the other interesting thing about that was I looked at what plane, who that plane belonged to, and it wasn't the Royal Air Force, the British Air Force, which had been running these flights for 18 months. It was an American company. And we saw that it had gone from RAF Akrotiri. And that was extremely interesting. And at that point, we didn't know whether it had been contracted by the British, the Americans, the Israelis, or even a private entity like the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. But the media got interested after that video came out, and a Times journalist through MOD, Ministry of Defense sources, found that, yes, the UK military had contracted out a US corporation to run these flights. And that plane is still at RAF Akrotiri and still going over Gaza, we think. We don't know because it's completely turned off its transponder now, so we don't even know when it's taking off and landing, but we know it's still there. And this is direct participation in genocide. It's not anything else. It's not to do with hostage rescue. It's not to do with anything in line with international law. This is direct participation in genocide, and that's why they tried to keep it secret and always kept the flight path secret. The other interesting thing that came out subsequent to that video being released was this Times journalist also got the Ministry of Defense source to say that this information that the British are collecting and have been collecting over Gaza was going to the Israeli military. And not only that, going to the Israeli military in real time, so while the plane is in the sky. Now, up till that point, when the government had been asked, they'd always said, we only pass it to relevant authorities. They'd never said what those relevant authorities were. We could guess that it was the Israeli military as they were running the operation, but we never could say for a fact. But now we know that it's been going to the Israeli military. We know that it's been going in real time. So this is direct participation in genocide. Britain is leading in providing intelligence to the Israelis. Al Jazeera did an investigation that found nearly half of all surveillance flights over Gaza during the genocide have been done by the British. More than double Israel itself. That's the Al Jazeera finding. So it's an insane scenario. And now the British taxpayer is paying an American corporation to run these spy flights for the Israelis, and we're not even allowed to know how much that contract costs us. So we're paying to participate in genocide, and we're not even allowed to know how much.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your input, Matthew Kennard, author and independent investigative journalist. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that does it for this edition of Unscripted. You heard the words of Matthew Kennard, obviously painting what seems to be a very not positive future ahead for the West Asia region in particular, and, of course, the Palestinians themselves. From Mikavi Tapwai and the entire team here at Unscripted, it's goodbye.
AM waking up for Fajr, gotta make wudu, gotta pray my sunnah, got me ghusl, gotta clip my nails, looking outside the sun is rising, up in the sky everybody's rushing, gotta get down to the masjid, gotta say salam to the imam, sitting in the first saf, chilling in the back saf, gotta make my mind up, do what the prophet did, it's Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah, gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to the Ajr. Miss Wakim, Miss Wakim, yeah! Miss Wakim, Miss Wakim, whoa! Pray, 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 pray. Gotta read Surah Al-Kahf. 12:45, the imam's on the minbar, talking about something like fiqh as a cat. They're whispering, chatting from the crowd. Don't they know that it's a haram? I stand up, you stand up. Praise about to start by the qamat yusala. Foot to foot, shoulder to shoulder. Just don't step on me. Sitting in the first saf, chilling in the back saf. Gotta make my mind up. Do what the prophet did. It's Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah. Gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah, gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to the Ajr. Miss Wakim, Miss Wakim, yeah! Miss Wakim, Miss Wakim, whoa! Pray, 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 pray. Gotta read Surah Al-Kahf. It's Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah, gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah, gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy.
May peace, mercy, and God's blessings be upon you. However, if you do not comply and intentionally delay, we testify that with God's assistance, we will invade your land by force. We will declare war on you using all means and methods at our disposal. We will bring you under the yoke and obedience of the Church and their majesties. We will capture you, your wives, and your children, reducing you to slavery. Then we will sell you off and dispose of you as ordered by their majesties. We will confiscate your property and inflict as much harm and damage as possible on those who resist accepting their rightful master. We warn you that the resulting deaths and losses will be solely your responsibility, not that of their majesties, nor ours, nor of these knights accompanying us. In the early 16th century, specifically after 1510, Spanish conquerors
arrived on the shores of the New World, which would later be known as America. They recited this text, part of which I have just quoted, called the Requerimiento, a term that suggests a request. Read in Latin to indigenous peoples who did not understand the language, its aim was not to communicate, but to legitimize future violence. This justification was aimed at the invaders themselves. It served as a certificate of impunity granted to criminals before they committed their crimes. With this document, the Spanish conquerors declared that the indigenous peoples, labeled as barbarians, had to submit to the Kingdom of Spain and the Pope of the Catholic Church. They were to surrender and convert to Christianity or otherwise take full responsibility for their fate. These were communities living on their own lands, posing no threat to Spain, Europe, or the Pope in Rome, and who were even unaware of their existence. Yet Spain and the Church claimed the right to massacre, enslave, and destroy their societies while blaming the victims for their own extermination. This colonial mindset, which dehumanizes the colonized, blames them for the crimes committed against them, and justifies their subjugation, is not a relic of the past. It's a policy that remains in effect today. In the conflict against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip during the years 2023, 2024, and 2025, we have heard chilling echoes of the logic of the Requerimiento. The policy adopted by the occupying entity was articulated by Israeli President Isaac Herzog, who stated that all Palestinians in Gaza, without exception, were responsible for the attack on October 7th. He also stated that there were no innocent civilians in the area. Everyone was involved. Since then, a campaign has been launched to blame the Palestinian people, the forces that chose to confront the occupation, and those who supported them. Victims of all crimes committed by the occupying entity are now being held accountable. This process often begins with the collective demonization of the victims. The clearest expression of this policy was given by Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Yoav Gallant, immediately after October 7th, when he referred to Gazans as human animals and imposed a total blockade that denied them water, food, and electricity. This tone has been repeatedly heard throughout colonial history. Labels such as savages and barbarians were applied to indigenous populations to justify their persecution and extermination. In their official documents, for instance, the Spanish described the nations they invaded as barbaric, while the British branded the resistance fighters in their colonies as savages. Colonial policy throughout the centuries has been based on three fundamental principles: dehumanizing the inhabitants of the land to justify their extermination and all the atrocities committed against them, holding the inhabitants of the land responsible for whatever happens to them, regardless of whether they fought to defend their existence and liberate their territory, despairing the victims of colonialism by making them believe that the cost of any confrontation is greater than what they can endure, and that the only measure of victory or defeat is who suffers more. In other words, the significant sacrifices made in each battle are seen as a defeat and a testament to the inability to confront colonialism. Therefore, the best course of action is to submit and surrender. If you choose to stand up against it, the second rule applies. You are accountable for everything that happens to you. Even if you opt not to confront it, you, due to your so-called retrograde, barbaric, and savage nature, are responsible for everything that occurs when the colonizer decides to exterminate or expel you from your land. It's true that the 20th century witnessed a significant shift with the establishment of a system of international laws, including international humanitarian law, which criminalizes collective punishment and the excessive use of force. However, this legal framework has remained almost entirely in the hands of the white man, the collective West, and the global North. Regarding the peoples of the global South, our countries, Africa, Latin America, and Asia, they have continued to be subjected to the same barbaric and savage colonial and slavery policies that dehumanize the victims of colonialism and slavery, blaming them for all the crimes committed by the colonial machinery. In our countries and throughout all regions of the global South, the Requerimiento remained the guiding document. It marked a foundational moment in the history of colonial genocide. a brief and brazen text that opened the door to centuries of bloodshed against entire peoples under the banner of eliminating the savages or expanding civilization and under the slogan, "You are the guilty ones." In 2023, 2024, and 2025, we observe the descendants of the colonizers stationed at the borders of the Gaza Strip, facing the Palestinian people, reciting the same text to them. In this episode, we will not delve into the foundational text of colonial brutality, but rather the colonial politics itself, which persists to this day and holds the victims accountable for everything.